NetSuite by Oracle brings accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce costs everywhere. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet.
This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Olshan, the editor of MarketWatch, and I'm pleased today to welcome biographer and professor Walter Isaacson, author of best-selling biographies of, among others, Einstein, Da Vinci, Ben Franklin, and Steve Jobs, a man who also has the distinction of having edited both magazines and jeans. Welcome, Walter, and thanks for being here.
It's a great pleasure. Wonderful show you have.
Your new book, The Codebreaker, is a little different from the ones I mentioned. I think, you know, almost weirder, but in a good way, because it's part biography of CRISPR pioneer and Nobel laureate Jennifer Doudna, part history of biotech, part treatise on the balance between free market competition and collaboration, and part ethics symposium. It's kind of ominous and optimistic at the same time, and as always, a good yarn. I guess to begin with, like, was this a harder story for you to tell than focusing on people and events decades or centuries in the past?
Oh, no, because it became a real adventure story, a journey of discovery. I almost felt like I was riding alongside them, both Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier and George Church and Fong Zhang and all the people in my book, as things were being discovered. So it reads to me more like a real-time detective narrative than, you know, a book about, say, Leonardo da Vinci, which feels very historic. And so it was pretty exciting. The cast of characters is colorful. The narrative has a lot of competition and cooperation in it. And then there's unexpected turns, such as when the Chinese doctor announces that he's made inheritable edits in embryos, or then when COVID strikes, or when the Nobel Prize happens. So it's sort of these events propel the narrative along.
Yeah, you paint two very different pictures of scientists in the book, I'd say. On the one hand, you know, characters you mentioned like Doudna are driven by curiosity, they're collaborative, and the pursuit of discovery and understanding. On the other hand, scientists can be, you know, cutthroat jerks, you know, sniping, petty, you know, there's big egos, more concerned with intellectual property and bragging rights than the common good. I mean, is that, it seems like a contradiction, but is, you kind of, I get the feeling you make the case we're better off for that contradiction.
Well, absolutely, we're better off because of competition. You know, competition is what drives us all forward at times, and so does collaboration, so does cooperation. And certainly there's a lot of rivalries and competitions and races in this book, but that's true of every company ever been talked about on MarketWatch. It's true of every journalist. We all like having scoops and winning prizes and sometimes getting patents. But the thing about the scientists is they're doing it as part of a noble calling. And they were reminded of that when Jennifer Doudna and the 50 scientists she had gathered in the Bay Area to fight COVID a year ago to turn their attentions to the coronavirus pandemic, and likewise the teams around MIT and Harvard that were her rivals, they all throw in together and start publishing publicly and not asserting intellectual property rights as they all engage in that fight against the coronavirus pandemic. And so I think sometimes in life and sometimes in business and sometimes in journalism and sometimes in science, you get reminded of why are we in this? What's the purpose of this all? And in this case, scientists always have certain ambitions for prizes, for patents, for publications, you know, for acclaim. But also they know they're doing it to make us safer and to help the human species. And I don't think that the competition in my book between Jennifer Doudna's realm and the other scientists trying to discover CRISPR was really all that bad. It's something you see in The Double Helix by Jim Watson when they're racing to discover DNA. And certainly when I was, you know, running a news organization or running a business, you know, I knew how to compete. People say, well, Jennifer Doudna is pretty competitive, isn't she? I say, yeah, that's a great thing about her and every other scientist in the book.
You get into some of the arcana of the of patent law and that dispute, and when all the lawyers get in and how, you know, that heightens a lot of the what you were just talking about. But the best detail I thought was Doudna's principal rival, Zhang, who you mentioned. I guess his team filed for the patent second, but they wisely paid a little extra to expedite it, and they got theirs approved first. And there's a lesson in there.
Well, this was under a system that no longer exists now, which was instead of being the first to file, you had to prove you were the first to discover. And so they both filed in 2012 for certain patents. But yeah, there's an expedited patent, as most of your listeners know, you know, course, which involves paying a little bit more money, but also agreeing to certain restrictions. And that's the route that Feng Zhang took. It's still tied up in patent court, which is a shame. I remember, writing about how when Jack Kilby and Robert Noyce both almost simultaneously invented the microchip, and then in the 60s and 70s got into their patent battle, they finally, Noyce finally called up Kilby. And there's a great business maxim, which is let's not fight over divvying up the proceeds until we finish robbing the stagecoach. And they were able to settle and cross-license their patent thing. I suspect that's going to happen between the Broad Institute and the Jennifer Doudna, Emmanuel Charpentier teams. But until then, the companies that want to use these patents are going to have to license, in some cases, both of them. And you have rival companies now using the patents.
What you just said made me think, it's how early stages, we are in this, revolution you're writing about. I mean, it's like writing about the digital revolution, maybe in the early 80s, say. I mean, you have this great detail. You mentioned that Zhang was at Harvard, at the same time as Mark Zuckerberg. And let me just find the quote. You say, it's interesting to speculate on which of them will end up having the most impact on the world. We say it's a proxy for the bigger question, whether the digital revolution or the life science revolution will end up being the more important. It sounds like you think it's too early to know that, but the potential for this technology seems as great as the digital revolution has been. Like, this is more fundamental to humanity than social media or smartphones.
Well, there's nothing more fundamental than to humanity than both our genetic coding and... I'm sorry, did you want to say something?
No, go ahead.
Okay. There's nothing more fundamental to our genetic coding than to our, essential nature than our genetic coding. And so I do think that the life sciences revolution will be far surpass things like Facebook. I mean, Facebook has had... it's been pretty good at connecting us. It's also been pretty good at dividing us at times. But I think that the next 50 years are going to be far more determined by advances in genetic editing, but also using genes, using molecules the way we use microchips, using molecules to recode them so that they can become messengers to create proteins in our Pfizer and Moderna vaccines against COVID, or as guides to what genes we might want to cut and change in the human race. So I do think that Zuckerberg's the more famous of the two from that class at Harvard, but 50 years from now, we'll probably be more impacted by what Feng Zhang and, of course, the others, Feng Zhang, Jennifer Doudna, and Emmanuel Charpentier did.
You write a lot about the interplay between science, the private sector, and government, in this story, and both before and after COVID. I wanted to talk about a key ingredient to the discovery that makes CRISPR possible. to me, amusingly, came from the yogurt industry. Can you talk about that and what it says about how we should think about that, you know, how those three, you know, separate culture, you know, groups, you know, interrelate?
Yeah, well, there's a model of innovation that goes back to Vannevar Bush during World War II, which says that basic science leads to discoveries, the discoveries lead to inventions, and the inventions lead to useful applications. And the way we've done it in the United States very successfully is we have the federal government tends to do a lot of the funding of basic research, but it's done in academic labs. At universities, and then corporations are able to translate that into commercial products and great inventions that help our society. But sometimes that sort of process doesn't work quite as simply or as linearly. There's sort of an interactive dance between those doing the applications and those doing the basic science. And two of the favorite characters in the book are Philippe Horvath and Rodolphe Bahlingu, both who work for Danisco, the French food company that does bacterial cultures for yogurts and cheeses. And that's a multi-billion dollar industry. And the main threat to the industry is the way that viruses can attack the bacteria in the cultures. And so they have a record over the years of all the bacteria cultures they've had, what viruses attack, and the sequences of their DNA. So these two guys at Danisco were able to look back at that history and make a really fundamental discovery about CRISPR, and that's the gene editing tool we've been talking about, which is that CRISPR is used in bacteria so that it can take a snapshot of any virus that ever attacked them and then use that snapshot to defend against the virus if it attacks again. Well, that's pretty useful to us in this day of recurring pandemics, but it's also the way that we learned how CRISPR works. And it was this wonderful collaboration between two very practical food scientists at the Danisco with the theoretical and basic scientists like Jennifer Doudna and Jillian Banfield and Francisco Mojico and the other people who were early on looking at how CRISPR worked.
You tell of when Doudna left the academy to work at Genentech, and she hated it and did not fit in. You know, even as much as she was interested in finding the practical applications you're talking about, and not just doing the basic science. What do you think that says about who can succeed in those two spheres? Like, why was that a bad fit? I mean, you've talked to scientists, you know, successful in both areas. What's the difference?
I think that she didn't feel comfortable in that large corporate culture. You have to remember that Genentech, the company, was a startup in the 1970s. It was one of the great biotech startups that came out of the discoveries about recombinant DNA and genetic engineering and was a huge success and helps invent the biotech industry. But as it got bigger, I think Jennifer Doudna, like a lot of people who would watch the show, felt more comfortable both doing the basic research, but also with startup companies, companies that were easier for her to have a deep influence on. So I think that detour she made for a very short period working for Genentech, she goes back to Berkeley to become a research scientist, but then she starts forming companies. She forms Caribou, which is using CRISPR technology as a therapeutic against genetic diseases. She forms Mammoth, which is using the technology as a detection technology against viruses, quite notably the current coronavirus thing. So some people are more interested in being in the lab. Some people are interested in being part of corporations. And some people like Jennifer like being in the lab, but they also like the thrill and the intimacy of creating a startup that will probably eventually be bought by big corporations. But she was entrepreneurial, and I think she felt that being a top-level person in a big corporation didn't suit her as well. And we all have to learn that in life. You know, where do you fit?
Right. The other group that you spend time with is neither in the academy or in these startups or corporations, but this kind of biohacker. You compare it to the homebrew computing club, the early days of computers. And you said that even a lot of the scientists have come around to the idea that there's benefit of these. It sounds scary that, like, as you described, people can buy kits to, do their own genetic editing at home. Seems terrifying to me. But the scientists think there's value in having just regular people, citizen scientists, a part of this process of discovery. Was that surprising to you?
Yeah, I think that the Homebrew Computer Club and the hackers of the cyber frontier back in the 70s and 80s were the ones who really pushed the personal computer revolution forward. Up until then, you'd had big corporate computers and academic computers, and you would not have had the digital revolution had it not been for places like the Homebrew Computer Club, where Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak could show off their little things they had done in their garage, and Bill Gates could, meet with members of the club and show the BASIC he had written for the PC. And so when it comes to biology, it's hard to have the same type of hackers in the forefront because, doing genetic engineering is a little harder to do in a dorm room or garage, but there are a lot of people doing it. Josiah Zahner, the one you mentioned, pops up in my book quite often, like Puck in Midsummer Night's Dream, sort of saying what fools these mortals be, and says, I'm going to push science forward by doing citizen science. Well, that horrifies a lot of people in the academy and, scientific researchers. But by the time I got to know Josiah Zahner and some of the others in this frontier, I realized that they play an important role. They help test the boundaries, and even the Defense Department has now invited him to one of its meetings to say, okay, how are we going to defend against cyber bio attacks? So when you're starting a new industry, Steve Jobs said, sometimes you need the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the round pegs in the square hole, because they're the ones that push the human race forward. That was part of his 1997 Think Different ad, and I try in my book to have a lot of people in that Think Different category.
Yeah, one thing you talk about when you yourself had the chance to edit a gene is that one remarkable thing about Doudna's discoveries is how relatively easy it is to do this, and then grappling with the implications. If editing genes is as easy as editing, in Gmail, you spend a lot of time in the book in getting at the ethical and moral dilemmas this raises, what did you make of, obviously you didn't do it totally by yourself, but you found the steps, it was not as, like rocket science, I guess.
Yeah, after writing about Einstein, there's no way I could have gone and made an atom bomb. But after working with Benedict and the but after working with Jennifer Doudna and the other people in her lab, it's pretty easy. You can get from on the internet for $150-$200 kits that allow you to edit genes using CRISPR technology. The difficult part is delivering them into human cells. But it's why this technology is something we're all going to have to figure out, how to keep the genes and the genie in the bottle on it. I found it simple enough to do, but as I said, we flushed it down the drain with a lot of chlorine, so I didn't unleash these new organisms into the planet. And it would have been hard for me to be able to, insert them into the correct human, like I did kidney cells. Delivering them into the body is something that the businesses that are in this realm, that's what they have to conquer, is the delivery mechanisms for genetically edited cells.
Right. I just want to remind everyone watching this, if you have questions, please submit them now. We'll try to get to as many of them as we can at the end. Just talking back to the ethical quandaries this presents. In one thread in all your books, has been, I think, the how interrelated the sciences and humanities are. And that, you know, you talk a lot about that with, I think, both, you know, Da Vinci, you know, Jobs, he made a big deal of that, and you know, Ben Franklin too. Do you think that to get, you know, the who we need to help us make those, you know, ethical decisions, or what the guardrails are? Is it scientists? Is it people in other fields? Like, you know, who should be deciding this? And is there, are there new fields of study that don't yet exist?
Well, when Jennifer first helped create this new technology, she had a nightmare. And it was that somebody wanted to learn how to use it. She walks into the room and it's Hitler. And so she decides she's going to start gathering not only scientists, but politicians from around the world, ethicists, philosophers, and try to figure out, when should we use it? Should we use it only in living patients with their consent? Or should we be able to make inheritable edits that will be passed down to future generations? Should we do it only for pure medical need, like curing sickle cell or cystic fibrosis or muscular dystrophy or Tay-Sachs? Or should we do it for enhancements, like to make kids taller or change their eye color, if we could do that? And these are questions that in the book, there's not a simple answer in the end of the book. We're saying, here's the answer key to all these. But I try to have a journey of discovery, just like the book has the journey of discovery about science. This is a journey of discovery with the same people and then some others, you know, some ethicists and philosophers and patients and kids, a journey of discovery of how we're going to deal with this new technology. It's sort of like Prometheus snatching fire from the gods. One of the ethicists, so to speak, in the book is a 17-year-old kid named David Sanchez. And he loves playing basketball, except when he doubles over in pain from sickle cell. And the scientists tell him, you know, we may be able to have this treatment, this CRISPR editing, so we can edit your reproductive cells so your children will never have sickle cell and their children won't. And he said, well, that's really wonderful. And then he has second thoughts and he says, but maybe it should be up to the kids after they're born. And they say, why? He said, well, sickle cell actually taught me empathy. It taught me persistence. It helped forge my character. And so you, that second thought is interesting. And then much later, I go back to him and I say, do you still think maybe you shouldn't do it to prevent your kids from having sickle cell? He said, no, you're right. I don't want my kids to have sickle cell. If this were available, I'd do it. And I'd try to teach them empathy, but I, you know, don't want them to suffer the way I did. So all the people in my book have first thoughts and second thoughts and third thoughts. And I think that's the way we're going to have to go down this slippery slope. It'll be a little bit less slippery if we do it step by step and cautiously and do it hand in hand.
And the, I guess, the wake-up call, which you alluded to, is the scientist in China who, I guess, edited the embryos to have babies who would be unable to get, they'd be resistant to HIV. And that sort of freaked everyone out because it was the first person to cross that Rubicon. And now we're in the way you write about how we're sort of in a, that's on hold, but not banned. Do you think we're going to, that Rubicon will be crossed again soon based on all the scientists you've talked to? I mean, they seem eager to go there.
When you talk about the Rubicon, it's sort of that line between doing it in a patient versus doing it in inheritable ways. So it'll be passed along to all the children and descendants. And the Chinese scientist did it to edit out the gene that allows the babies to get HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. And people were horrified by that because he had crossed that line of doing inheritable edits. And it wasn't safe, the world wasn't ready for it. But I think after us suffering this past year through this pandemic, some of us have our minds a little bit more open about, well, once it's safe and once we're able to do it without off-target and unintended consequences, if we could make ourselves and our species a little bit less susceptible to viruses, would we do it, you ask? And yeah, I think we have to open our minds and say someday we will probably make edits that help make us healthier. I mean, every creature on this planet, large and small, uses the tricks they have in their and the tools they have in their toolbox to try to thrive. And this is one that our species, the human species, learned, which is in order to thrive, we might want to edit some of our genes. But boy, I would do it really cautiously, especially with inheritable edits. We're not anywhere close to wanting to do that now. We should focus on doing it in patients who give their informed consent to fight very specific genetic diseases that can be fixed easily, and we know what it looks like to not have the gene for sickle cell or not have the mutation that causes Huntington's. Those are the ones we should focus on now.
All right, before we get to questions, there's one final thing I wanted to ask. Doudna, one thing that stands out about her is that you say, I think pretty early on, that she was always interested in tackling very big questions. And yet at the same time, she understood that science, it doesn't advance with great leaps, but in these small steps. And it seems like that again, if you're the expert on, the genome, I guess, of great and successful thinkers and people, that seems, you could say the same thing about Jobs or a Franklin or what from doing all these books, what are the traits you think that are most shared by, this pretty impressive group you've chronicled?
Well, I think curiosity is the one thread that ties them all together, just curiosity about the basic wonders of nature, which are beautiful in and of themselves, but also turn out, like the case of CRISPR, to be useful. Likewise, whether it's Leonardo da Vinci or Jennifer Doudna, you're right. I think that being interested in all fields of endeavor, you get to sort of see the patterns of nature. I found Leonardo to be totally an inspiring person. Steve Jobs is the one who said I should write about him because he connected the humanities to the sciences. And that's something that you see with some of the good scientists in my book, whether it be Jennifer Doudna or George Church.
All right, I'm looking at the questions. Several readers want to know which companies you think are most interesting in sort of making most interesting use of CRISPR and showing the potential.
Not talking necessarily about the pricing of public companies, but just companies that have been founded recently. The rivals and competitors and colleagues in my book ended up founding three different companies. CRISPR Therapeutics is the one done by Emmanuel Charpentier, and that's the one that's been able to help fight sickle cell and has already been in use, in partnership with Vertex. So those two companies are very good and succeeding in this technology. And from Feng Zhang and George Church and initially Jennifer Doudna, there's a company in Cambridge called Editas. And that too has some of the intellectual property that's important for gene editing. And out in California, there are two companies that came out of Jennifer Doudna's orbit. That's Mammoth Biosciences, which uses this technology for detection. And they're going to come out with a home testing kit that will, I think, be transformative, because it will not only test for COVID, it'll test for anything that has genetic material in it. And it'll be like a home pregnancy test. You'll be able to do it easily at home. And this will come out in the next 4 or 5 months. And they'll be able to test, not only, as I say, for COVID, but like, does your kid have strep throat? Do you have a bacterial infection? Has the cancer recurred? And so I would look very carefully at Mammoth Biosciences, but also Sherlock Biosciences out of Cambridge, Mass, and out of Feng Zhang's group, that's doing the same thing with these easy-to-use home testing kits for any genetic thing. That will help bring the biosciences revolution into the home. And like the iPhone, it'll be a platform upon which other innovators can build their own applications, so that if you have this cartridge, you put saliva into it, and it tests for these things, somebody may come along with an application about your gut microbiome or anything. So I think I would look at basically these detection technologies as being the next big thing.
And you talked about the timeline and, you know, comparing it to the iPhone, like the distance in time from the advent of, you know, microchips and, you know, personal computers to when their widespread adoption is over decades. We're only 9 years since that the initial paper that Doudna wrote. What's your sense from talking to all these scientists? Like how far out are we from the widespread, you know, adoption of CRISPR and similar technologies?
I think the thing that's coming next is to be able to advance the gene editing technology so it can do multiple genes. It can do it without as many off-target problems that could occur or unintended consequence. And where you can take whole sequences and stitch them in to our genetic code. The leaders in that are Beam Therapeutics, BEAM, which comes out of mainly the work being done by David Liu, L-I-U is how you spell his last name, at Harvard. And so as I go to these CRISPR conferences, I'm just amazed that every year there are these great leaps forward. People said CRISPR is not going to be all that easy to use because it's, you know, a little bit of a blunt instrument, and sometimes it hits off-target places in our genome. And boom, people like David Liu come along with base editing, prime editing, and Sam Sternberg has come along with something using transposons, which are jumping genes, which allow you to actually move one whole gene to another place in our DNA. So it's progressing even faster than the digital revolution did, especially as we use not just CRISPR-Cas9, but CRISPR-Cas12 and 13, which can be detection technologies. And as we use these things like base editing, where you don't even have to do a double-stranded break in the DNA in order to make an edit.
The one last question, the couple, you know, sort of hinted at, was beyond CRISPR, what other areas of biotech should we be looking at that also are showing promise right now, or that are related but maybe not getting as much attention?
Yeah, there are two areas I would be looking at. One is cancer fighting, of which CRISPR will play an important role, and specifically immunotherapy and targeted immunotherapy and personalized immunotherapy. You know, we're pretty far along the road in that, but cancer is a very clever enemy, and sometimes it's able to disable our immunotherapy systems. And what we're being able to do with CRISPR, both in China and in the University of Pennsylvania in the past year, is to use CRISPR to disable the defense mechanisms a cancer might use against the immunotherapy. That's a bit complex, but that's going to be an enormous leap forward, because cancer is the big one to conquer. And the best way, I think, to conquer it will be tailored, personalized immunotherapies against the thousands of, you know, cancers that could possibly exist. The other thing is the combination of artificial intelligence and genetic coding, where we're going to be able to take computational biology. People like Cameron Myhrvold, who's just moved from Harvard, I think, to the University of to Princeton, be able to use computational biology in connection with people who are doing CRISPR-type reprogramming of molecules using the genetic code.
Fascinating. All right, well, that is unfortunately all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for being here, Walter. This is a pleasure. We hope you listen to our next episode tomorrow, which is actually on a similar theme. Barron's senior managing editor, Lauren Rublin, will explore the future of the life sciences industry and related investments with Barron's healthcare reporter, Josh Nathan Kazis, and Joel Marcus, executive chairman and founder of Alexandria Real Estate Equities, one of the nation's largest life science REITs. Thank you again for listening. Stay healthy and have a great day.
Thank you, Jeremy. Bye-bye.